said to me as I left school, you need a job to pay your way. Cause things cost money and you're gonna need things. That's just the way things are today. So I left home and went to work at just 16. Started feeding the machine. Me and my brother moved into a flat. I paid my share of bills and rent. I got paid on a so-called Thursday. By Sunday night it was gone. That's how the weekends are all spent. And when the calendar's got you slaving for the 5 days in between, you're just feeding the machine. Got married, we had a couple of kids. I love them dearly to this day. But to put food on our table, put clothes on our backs, I needed lots more pay. I got me a work promotion, but the tax man stripped me clean. I'm mostly feeding his machine. I had to get a big loan. That's called a mortgage, I hear you cry. And that means death pledge. And that's because it feels like you're paying till you die. And most of it's interest that goes to the banks to team. They love us feeding their machine. Got me a raise, I kept aiming for the top. But as my pay went up, so did my debts, and the interest never stops. I met me a bankster, he said, son, you may be keen, but you're just feeding my machine. Began to realize what was going on, and how those banksters call the shots. They run the system, all based on debt. Lending money they ain't got. So it don't matter if you work hard, if you're generous or mean. From what I've seen, you're just feeding the machine. I did miss some learning about how it all works and how they trick you right from birth. Your name is money to them when you're playing the surf, but you sweat and your talent's what you really worth. But if you're reaping what you're sowing at the ignorance latrine, shit, you're just feeding the machine. And if you don't know where you're going and you're not sure where you've been, probably feeding the machine. But when your wisdom is showing you what a fool you've been, you'll stop feeding the machine. Let's stop feeding the machine. We're all feeding the machine. So let's stop feeding the machine.
Litmus there, and let's stop feeding the machine. His website is projectfreeman.com, where you can read all about his doings in the past. But right now he's on the line with me. Thanks very much for joining us, Litmus.
It's great to be back with you, man.
And almost to the day, you tell me, since we last spoke.
Yeah, happy new year. Happy new year. 13516 in the universal community calendar. because in that calendar it's perennial, so the days don't move. But, you know, because you always do a Thursday in the Gregorian, that would have been March the 27th last year. But if we'd have done it on my calendar, you'd be on the same day.
It's really good, that, because that's a perfect demonstration of why it is we need that sort of calendar and not the one that we've got.
Yeah, the one we got is a big mind F-U-C-K, man.
certainly is. I always say if somebody gave you a, ruler and the first 3 inches were different lengths, you'd give it back to them and ask for a proper one.
Exactly, mate. It's a good analogy, that. And as you know, in the UCC, there's 12 months and they're all 30 days, all exactly the same, 3 weeks or 10 days. So you don't get any of this moving, you know, with the 7 day week nonsense, you know.
Makes it a lot easier for you to navigate your way through time. And it strikes me as being, I'm sure we'll be talking about frequencies later, but it strikes me as being a truer frequency.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's definitely, as you know, it all revolves around the 5 special days of like New Year's Day and the 4 days we have for the 2 equinoxes and the 2 solstices. So it's very much in tune with what the Earth and the Sun and all the planets and stuff are doing, you know, and the energies as they change through the year. So once you get back into realizing that, you know, the year starts kind of now with the spring in the north and the autumn in the south, or, you know, some of the ancients used to start at the other equinox.
They did, didn't they? They used to start at sort of early in June or in the middle of June.
Yeah, but, you know, if you look at all the guys, all the old guys who kind of knew what was going on before the age of ignorance, you know, they either started at what I call the Nobinox, you know, the northbound equinox that we've just had, or the southbound equinox, the Sobinox, as I call it, you know, what we call the autumn one. Of course, in the southern hemisphere, it's all the other way round. So, but if you start at one of the 2 equinoxes, you're starting from a point of balance, you know, the planet's balanced, the energies are balanced, and you go from there into the sine wave, you know. So it just feels a lot more natural, you know, to go with those cycles rather than this arbitrary kind of, I mean, it's not even middle of winter, you know. The Gregorian one starts on this 1st of Jan thing, which is actually when we align with Sirius, you know, as people like Satnus Bonacci and I have pointed out. So I think this, I I've been living by this calendar for a few years now, and it's certainly changed my, I don't know what it's changed really. It's changed my psyche, I guess. And
can you put your fingers on any of the changes that you've seen since abandoning the Latin calendar? Because you, like I say, I've been working on it for a while now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the main one is, you know, there's none of this weekdays and weekends business, and none of this, you know, where you only get like 1 or 2 days off, and then you have to work the rest.
Yeah. You still managing to busk your way into enough food and find enough things to keep yourself kind of fed and watered?
Yeah, well, I'm quite fortunate now because I got a bit of money from my old job, you know. So having had 10 years of, as you say, busking and doing the music stuff to make ends meet, I'm now in a bit more fortunate position where I got a bit of cash coming in, but. You know, we know none of that's real anyway, so...
Yeah, it's all just helping you to swim in the stream, really.
Yeah, you know, and I suppose the main change is just treating every day kind of the same, really, as a new day, you know, a happy new day, as you would say.
Yes.
You know, and not kind of thinking, oh, I've got to do this today because the calendar says it's Saturday, or I've got to do this because I got to go to work tomorrow, or, you know... But
I think loads of people know how it feels to wake up on days like that from the things they get called holidays and weekends and stuff like that. But it is good to imagine that every day of the week, and then getting engaged in your own stuff, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, so the idea with the universal community calendar and the community bit, you know, obviously linking to the universal community trust, but the idea behind the community bit was with a 10-day week, you know, you just give 3 days to the community and the rest of the time you do your other stuff, you know.
And the other stuff you're doing would probably quite a lot of the time make you more useful to the community too.
Well, exactly, yeah, exactly. You know, and I know everyone's not in a position to do that straight away, and a lot of us are employed by someone else, like I used to be, you know. But if step one, you can get free of employment and take a step to sort of self-employment, and then from there, maybe even get out of that. You know, it is possible, but we all need some of these tokens to play in the game, don't we? So that's the main thing that stops most people doing it, you know.
Yeah, that's depending on how you're living, you might need quite a lot of those, but it is possible to sort of limit the requirement for them, isn't it?
Yeah, well, absolutely. In the way I did that when I needed to, one of the ways was, you know, living in a camper van. And especially if you live in a warmer climate, you know, you just don't spend all this money on fuel and energy and stuff. I mean, my songs, you might have noticed, I've called the recent ones Camper Van Demo. Just done them live in my camper van on a little voice recorder. And I'm also calling them solar powered songs because I've got a 55 watt solar panel that charges up my leisure battery. And so when I'm talking to you now live on a dongle and the laptop powered through an inverter off the leisure battery, which was topped up today by the solar panel. So, you know, if you can live quite cheaply, if you cut a few things that are unnecessary out. And yeah. I actually found I'm just a lot more happier, you know, with all this stuff, you know.
Well, we've been living pretty much that way at least half our time as well. I too have a leisure battery and a laptop, and we have candlelight and have a tendency to go to bed much closer to sunset. And get up whenever the sun gets up, really. And you're right, it does release the mind a little, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. And I find, like you say, we go to bed pretty much at sunset. And then I find I wake up in the middle of the night. I'm full of ideas and sort of messages or whatever you want to call them. And little musings and, you know, make a note of them in the journal or record them somehow, and then go back to sleep, have a really wicked sleep, and then in the morning you look back and you think, oh yeah, I'm glad I wrote that down, you know, because I might not have remembered that. But it's almost like you get 2 days in one, you know.
It's funny that, isn't it? Because I know that 3 o'clock in the morning time is when people who are, as it were, professional monks and in monasteries and stuff, the meditators, that's when they really like to get you up and get you meditating. Are you still there, or did we lose you?
Okay, it makes sense then. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, for the people. Hello. Yeah. Can you hear me? You all right?
Yeah, I can hear you, mate. As long as you can hear me, we're good.
Yeah, I can. Yeah, we're getting a little bit of the Dalek effect, but I should imagine that's from your dongle, and we'll just have to put that down to circumstance.
Yeah, well, I'm high up on a cliff top, overlooking the Atlantic. You know, down in the... Hello?
Hello, yeah, I keep losing you at the moment, which is going to make it a little difficult, isn't it? Well, I lost you again.
Hello?
Hello there.
You there?
Yes, I am indeed.
Hey.
I wonder if it's worth me trying to call you again.
Well, it could be my laptop, I don't know. Are we back? Are we okay now?
Yes, indeed, yeah, you're coming and going a bit, though. I'll have to let you know when you've gone so that you have to kind of keep track of what you're saying so you can go backwards a little bit. But we do seem to be having a fair bit of problem with this Skype connection.
Okay. Must be the dongle, mate, I guess.
Yeah, it was working all right earlier on. And
I tell you what, I'll call you, okay? Maybe you just chat for a second, I'll call you back.
Yeah, okay, go for it. Okay, so Litmus will try giving me another call, hopefully, and we'll see whether it works any better the other way round. It was working fine for us earlier on this afternoon. We did actually give it a good test, and funnily enough, I didn't have any trouble with the Skype at all. Perhaps it's just that things get a lot more busy at this time of night, and maybe there's more people trying to ride the bits of copper or whatever. You heard Litmus talking about a calendar he's put together there. Calendars, of course, have always been a thing of interest to me. Is in fact one of the first things that turned me on to the idea that things might not be quite as they seem to be when I started examining the Mayan calendar, which similarly runs in a much more steady track, shall we say, than the Gregorian calendar. It's in its way a lot easier to keep an eye on what exactly is going on. One of the things I enjoyed about it is that every day had a kind of traditional energy associated with it. So you have a 260-day cycle that you're moving through. And I use just that for a while. It is unfortunately necessary, a bit like it's necessary to have the meaningless promissory tokens. It seems to be necessary if you want to deal with the the everyday workaday world to be using the Gregorian calendar, but on the times when you can just concentrate on using something else, it looks like Litmus is having problems getting in touch with me. I'm just going to type in here. It's very difficult to talk and type at the same time. What I'm going to do, I think, is just I'm going to put another tune on and see if I can get anything better going on here. Oh, here's Litmus again. Let's give him another go. Hi there, Litmus.
Hey.
How you doing? Well, that sounds pretty clear at the moment.
Good.
Yeah, excellent stuff. We might have to do that a bit. So look, let's return to that new song of yours, that Feeding the Machine, which I think is a really great lyric. And perhaps before we get into talking about your free and your mind and your spirit and the rest, perhaps we should talk a little bit about just exactly what it was you were releasing yourself from. Because I was struck that in the very first verse, which is, only three or four lines long, you managed to cover dad, school, job, money and things, which is a good place to start. Is that what started waking you up to what was happening?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I suppose I started getting that feeling about waking up in the mid-90s, we might have talked about before. But, it went on from there, really, and gradually getting more and more aware of things and more free and out of employment and all the rest of it. And then when I just had this idea for the Feeding the Machine thing, because it is like a big machine, you know, and it's, once you're in it, it's quite hard to get out of it, and it sort of gets its claws into you. And so I just tried to do a little, I thought back over my life, you know, and thought, well, how did I get into it in the first place, you know? And I think we all just kind of just go along with things that we're told, you know, when we're younger, and this is how it is, you know, you go to school and you get exams and you know, that helps you get and go for an interview and get a job and start earning money. And then you know, have to buy stuff. And we don't even kind of think about it often. You know, we just end up doing it.
Yeah, I certainly didn't. It just sort of happens, doesn't it? And I guess that's really where authority is stamped upon us, isn't it, really, in those very early years?
Yeah, you know, and it starts like one of the verses in the song says, it starts right from birth. You know, you don't even know about it, but as anyone who's looked at the Freeman stuff knows, you know, they create a corporation in your name when you register for birth, and then they've got you in the machine, and then you start feeding it unknowingly, you know. And then when you kind of leave school and start work, you really start feeding it big time, you know, start paying tax and everything. So you don't always sort of question it. And maybe I remember hearing that song, Once in a Lifetime, Talking Heads, you know, and it sort of says, you may find yourself living in a shotgun shack or with a beautiful wife, and how did I get here, kind of thing. And I think maybe a lot of us start to do that towards our middle age, you know, we start thinking, how did I get here, actually, you know, and where did it all start? And
because it kind
of the idea with that,
it kind of builds up really subtly, doesn't it? Because I kind of remember those long summer holidays and stuff like that without any kind of financial responsibility at all, and then kind of bit by bit it gets kind of stacked onto you, which is a movement that I think you cover really well in the song, you know, from the job and up to the flat and the bills and the rent, and as you say, you find yourself only off on the weekend, which I heard recently pronounced as weekend, which I thought was quite good.
Weekend, yeah, that's brilliant. I definitely want to put that in a song.
Yeah,
well, I think absolutely. You know, I watched a little movie recently. It was a tip from a mate of mine called Sven. You might be listening down here, but it wasn't a great film, to be honest, Sven, if you're listening. I think it was called A Man from Earth. It was a good idea. I didn't kind of like the movie that much, but there was a line in it. One of the guys said, because these guys are all in a sort of cabin in the woods, you know, and they're sitting around drinking and chatting, and one of the guys says that the human body is designed to last about 190 years, but we all just slowly poison ourselves to death, you know.
Yeah, yes,
you know, and we do that a lot. We do a lot of that ourselves, but you know, obviously the machine kind of does a lot of poisoning and stuff as well, you know, with all the stuff we know about, you know, aspartame, fluoride, MSG and all the chemtrail stuff and everything else and stuff in the water. So, you know, that's kind of a slow drip kind of effect. But then obviously, like you say, on the weekend, we go out usually because we want to blow off some steam because we've been slogging away all week feeding the machine. So we go out and feed the machine more, buying booze and all the rest of it, and get trashed and probably kill a few body cells and brain cells that ain't going to come back, you know, and all have a great time. But a bit like the Saturnalia, you know, around what they call Christmas time. But, you know, again, we don't really think about why we're doing it. We just kind of do it because that's what everyone does. And we all, you know, your dad did it or your brother does it or your mates do it or whatever. So I don't know. It's just, I think for me, a lot of it's just about actually just stopping, you know, just kind of stop. Just take a step back and kind of look at what's going on as if you were like an alien visitor to the planet or something, you know?
I think that's a really important point, isn't it? Is that it is so upside down and back to front that it is really helpful to be able to step back and get out of it a bit and look at it for what it is. If nothing else, it's necessary to step aside a bit from the non-stop conditioning and data streaming that's occurring all around us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's there are a few spots down here at the moment where you can still get off the grid and there's no signals, you know, interfering with you, which is pretty good. But generally, as you say, they're everywhere. But I just try to kind of look back over the various sort of stages of my time in the machine, you know, and it's almost, yeah, like a little chronological history of what happened. And, yeah, you know, and you get a job and then you might meet someone and get married. You might have some kids. You got to rent somewhere, and then you think, well, why don't I buy somewhere? That makes sense, you know, instead of paying rent to someone else. So then you get one of these death pledges, you know, mortgages, and I don't think hardly any of us realize how much of that is interest, you know, there's some stuff on my website about that on part one of Project Freeman that tells you about, the land scam, exactly how much money on average they make on a typical mortgage. You know, it's crazy, crazy stuff. So you got all that, and then, you know, and then you get in, and then you get into some of the realization stuff about, you know, what's going on and how the bankers kind of run it. And then hopefully at the end you can sort of get out of it and just say stop, you know, let's stop feeding the machine.
Yeah, because it's absolutely the debt end of it, which is where you get to in about verse 5, I think, is the absolute inevitable conclusion of the whole setup, really, is that it looks like you're getting somewhere, but in debt is where you end up. And that's, I think you're in debt even if you're in credit, technically, aren't you?
Yeah, there is only debt. Money is debt, yeah.
And so, what was your first response? I mean, you've been abroad for some time now, but did you find it kind of too difficult to execute this stuff in the so-called United Kingdom, or did you just want the sunshine?
I did quite a lot of it in the so-called UK, or, you know, Great Britain, the island of Great Britain. And I did quite a lot of it there. I did a lot of my trials there, like deregistering cars and vans and you know, stopping paying tax and all the notices to the government and the parking tickets and all that testing kind of stuff.
And that all kind of worked for you, did it?
Yeah. I mean, all the evidence, that's all on part one of Project Freeman, so you can look at that there. And the majority of it worked, and I put all my learning online. And then I just got to a stage where I wanted to. I realized, you know, one of the ways to be really free was to get on the road, you know. And so I got a camper van and I headed off south and went busking in France and stuff, as you know. And I just love the sun, you know. I just love the sun. Gotta have sun. I can't survive without the sun.
I didn't realise how much of an effect. I mean, we spend a lot of our time outside anyway, but when I went to stay in Spain, I was amazed by how different it was to be able to get up and put a t-shirt and shorts on every day, unfailingly. And I found that I was eating less and that I was more alert and relaxed. It was really great. So I can quite see your love of sunshine. It's a bit damp around here.
Yeah, well, you know, I love the old home country, of course, and I love coming back for a visit. But I'm just It's in my birth chart. It's in my astrology as well, about the sun and the sort of time of year, you know, that's best. And I think, you know, maybe it's not for everyone, but I think a lot of people would benefit from a bit more sunshine. Yeah. And like I said, also, if you're going to live on the road in a van or whatever, it's just obviously much more sensible and easier and cheaper and everything to do it in a warmer climate.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, like I say, less food, certainly less energy. We don't have to burn a lot of wood. But I guess there's not a lot of that in Portugal. So did you, as a matter of interest, did you manage to deregister your machine when you were in the United Kingdom or the lands of the island of Great Britain?
I did, yeah. There is a lot of wood actually in Portugal, by the way.
But you don't have to burn it.
Well, you know, there's loads of pine cones and offcuts and things lying around. So if you got a wood burner as in your van as well, you're laughing because you got free fuel in. If you do need some through the colder nights of the winter, you know.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So, go on.
What was your question about the deregistering?
The deregistering of the machine, because I know there's many people who believe that's not possible, although it is obviously desirable.
Well, whether it's possible or not, you know, I have done it. I've done it twice. I've done it on a car and on my first camper van. You know, and I drove around without tax on them, and I did have sort of interactions with the cops and stuff, you know, and that's all on the website. So
yeah,
I had letters back from DVLA in response to my notices, and got to a stage where my final notice, you know, put the record straight, if you like, in terms of my understanding and their agreement to it. If they didn't reply, and they didn't reply, so I mean, you know, whatever anyone says, I know I've driven around for quite a long time, you know, without any tax, and the car goes fine without it, you know.
Yeah, indeed. Of course, you don't. Do you have any road tax over where you are now?
Well, there is. There is road tax in Portugal, but there's none in France. So, I'm in the process at the moment of. I mean, I've deregistered, if you like, the van I'm sitting in right now. That used to be in someone else's name, and that's now in my name and with my address in France. And I'm in the process of. I'm gonna register that one in France for the time being. Pending any UCT stuff, because there's no road tax in France, you know. So if you're going to register anywhere, register where there's no road tax, and then you're not feeding the machine that way and giving your money to the war and everything. So
why are you choosing to actually register it if you've got a successfully deregistered one? Are there any advantages to it?
Well, I haven't deregistered this one. Deregistered the car and the first van.
Yeah.
And with this one, I haven't sent any notices to DVLA or anything to deregister, because I'm gonna put it in France. So, you know, and then the benefit of that is you can come and go in and out of the United Kingdom, as they call it, on a French plate. You're not paying any tax. You're not going to get any hassle at all. And as ever, as long as you got MOT or its equivalent. And some insurance, so you're not putting your fellow man at risk. You're fine. So that's what I'm doing. But as I'm finding, you know, that there's the French bureaucracy is amazing for doing that. So it's taking quite a while to do it.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. How much stuff do you have to do to get this piece of paper?
A lot. I mean, I'm okay because I'm on I got cover notes. From my French insurers whilst it's being sorted, and that's, you know, so there's no problem there, but yeah, you need all sorts of things. I've had emails, you know, keep asking for more information. Basically, the main thing is you need a certificate of conformity, which basically says that your private conveyance, or whatever you want to call it, is conforms to some EU standard, you know. And it's crazy because I've got a VW T25. I mean, there's thousands of them everywhere. Why each one needs its own specific certificate to say it conforms when it was made by Volkswagen is amazing. But there
I know why that is, because in the days when I was a motorcyclist, I was still obliquely interested in politics, shall we say, and as far as it was affecting people who were riding motorcycles. And Europe was constantly trying to introduce such legislation, and it was constantly being voted down because of the abilities of motorcyclists to kind of move themselves about the place and camp, basically. But what they those are type approval regulations, if I recognize them rightly, and I bet they came in eventually. And they basically say that if you've got so much as a sticker on the machine that wasn't on there when it left the factory, then it's no longer standard. I mean, that perhaps a slight exaggeration, but not much of one.
No, I think you're right. It's not that much of an exaggeration.
Because there was a friend of mine once who was riding around on a motorcycle, and because he knew it should have silencers in it, what he did was he got himself a stainless steel sugar bowl, stamped it with the necessary British standards mark, and bolted it into the exhaust pipe. It was no more a silencer than I am, if you know what I mean. But he got away with it because it had the right number on it.
Crazy, man. Well, yeah. There's more than one way to skin a cat, isn't there?
Yeah. Okay, we've got a couple of... you fancy some questions from the chat box as we go through?
Yeah, of course, why not?
The first one's from John Jay. Interesting question, but I look forward to hearing what you make of this one. He says, what's your opinion on this flat earth conspiracy? Is it a CIA psyop or not?
I haven't got into that one too much. I saw something online recently about that, but to be honest, I wouldn't want to get distracted by looking at that too much.
It doesn't seem likely that the earth is flat to me, given what we know about the geometries of things.
Yeah, I mean, there's another one, I think, coming back. This is saying that, you know, we got a geocentric system and we're at the centre of the universe. So I don't know if they're just digging up some old ideas to play them out again. But, you know, I mean, none of us really know for sure until maybe we get to go into space or something and have a look. But
Or walk over the edge, of course.
Oh, we'll walk over the edge, yeah, this world. But, I try and avoid a lot of these debates on the internet, because a lot of them, I think, are put out, you know, the internet's full of agents, as we know. It's full of, you know, plants, if you like, going, stirring things up in forums and in debates and all the rest of it. And it's a classic sort of technique that the machine uses to divide and conquer people, you know. So whatever the issue is, whether it's, you know, the earth, do you believe it's a round earth or do you believe it's a flat earth? Well, then all you end up with is a big argument between all the flat earthers and the round earthers, you know.
Yeah, it's like Jonathan Swift's little Endians and big Endians who were arguing over which end to open an egg.
Absolutely. Gulliver's Travels and that, brilliant hermetic wisdom there in a story. As above, so below, you know?
Yes. Yes, I guess one of the questions to ask when you come across these sort of things is, does it matter?
Exactly. Does it matter? Or is it Dilly Gaff? Was it one of these Aussie Kevin Bloody Wilson, I think, had a song called Dilly Gaff, which stands for Do I Look Like I Give a Fuck, you know?
Yeah, indeed, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, I like to say, I try and avoid those kind of things. Similarly, something I wanted to talk to you about anyway was they do the same kind of thing. Two good examples at the moment are the so-called global warming debate and the chemtrail issue. Because what they do is divide us all into, if you take chemtrails, you know, do you believe chemtrails are chemtrails or are they just contrails? And then you get a load of people posting loads of stuff proving that they're just vapor trails. And then a load of other people posting stuff that proves they got barium and aluminium, whatever, in them. But if you just step back, have a look what's going on, try and rise above that, go up to the next level and look down at these two arguing factions, if you like. And the real issue is, you know, if you take chemtrails, whether they have contrails or whether they got chemicals in, either way, they're fucking up the sky, you know, and they're blocking out the sun. And there's often days here, you know, where it's a clear blue sky in the morning, and it's a busy flight day, and there's loads of planes going over, and by midday, it's cloudy, you know, and you can hardly see the sun. So whether that's just vapour or whether it's got something else in it, I don't want it. I don't want to see it. So the solution is to all stop flying everywhere so much, you know? and to do what we can to stop that as much as we can, and to expose things that we do find out that are going on, and sharing that information with each other.
And so I guess that's a move towards the synthesis of people and groups, isn't it? Is to get them to agree on the basic matter instead of spending a lot of time and energy arguing about minutiae.
Absolutely. My good kindred spirit, Blue Meanies, if he's out there listening, he'll tell you that my boys will both tell you that me and my brother, who's mentioned in the song, you know, who I moved into a flat with.
Yeah.
We've had many, should we call them, debates about issues that we disagree on, you know, and some violent sort of arguments. But, you know, there was one day at my houseboat at the time, and I said to him, for God's sake, bruv, let's just try and find the common ground, you know. Let's stop arguing about all the things we disagree on. Let's try and find something that we actually agree on. And we did, you know. And then we sort of had a list of taboo subjects that we realized there was not much point really debating anymore because, you know, we were both pretty convinced of our own arguments there, if you like. Yeah. But what we did was find the common ground. And the common ground in the chemtrail issue is stuff out of planes blocks out the sun, so let's stop it, you know. That's what we can all agree on.
Yeah.
Let's have less trails, whether they're con or chem. Let's have less trails. So that's point number one. And you got a similar thing with the global warming stuff. So you got everyone arguing about, is it man-made or is it not, you know, and all of that. Well, again, don't get into it. The simple thing is, it don't make sense to pollute. It don't make sense to shit in your own back garden. So just stop polluting. Let's all agree that we can all stop polluting as much as we can. And then it doesn't matter whether we're adding to global warming or not, you know. I think it's pretty obvious to anyone who kind of looks at things with a bit of common sense that the main thing that's going to affect the temperature on this planet is the sun. Because it's like 99.96% of the mass of the bloody solar system, giving out masses of, you know, solar radiation every day. So the sunspot cycle and the cycles of the sun, to me, it makes most sense about what's going to affect the temperature of the Earth. And of course, if we stick CO2 in the atmosphere, it's going to affect it. You know, I used to work in the energy industry, and I worked on sustainable development, and I was a huge advocate at the time of all of that stuff, and was a firm believer in global warming. You know, but even then, I started to see some articles from alternative points of view saying that no, maybe it's not, you know, man-made. And at the time, I kind of didn't even read them because I was so blinkered and so convinced that it was the issue, you know.
And there's now, of course, substantial numbers of articles saying, is it actually getting warmer?
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, it's getting warmer and it's getting cooler. It's a cycle. It goes up and down with the sunspot cycle, as far as I can see. And,
well, the thing I see about that is watching these suspicious observers vids and the like, and actually just watching what's happening to the weather at this very moment in America and various other places, is that records are tumbling by the day, hundreds of them apparently in America. It's the hottest, it's the coldest, it's the wettest, it's the driest. It's everything it could possibly be apart from normal.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, so I wouldn't really, because all these debates you get bogged down in, you know, they bring you down to a lower level and they stop you following your path. They stop you connecting with the rest of the universe, you know, and they stop you connecting with spirit and listening to your intuition. And instead you're on the internet all day, you know, arguing in forums and slagging people off and sending them data to prove your point and all this kind of stuff, you know, and it's just most of it's a complete waste of time.
And I think it actually makes it a lot more difficult for one to achieve whatever effects one could achieve if one's being distracted in that sort of way, that your own focus and intent are actually quite important on making sure that you know, your personal space is to make whatever improvement you can.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the reason we're all here is to quite selfishly follow our path once we know what it is. Because if we all individually do that, that's the best we can do for everyone as well, you know?
Yes, absolutely. That's completely right. That that it's, that's the best difference we can make is to ourselves, and that's the only thing that's going to make a difference to others.
Yeah, you know, so follow your path, do everything you can, because you can't control anyone else. You can't change people's minds necessarily. You know, you might persuade a few with some good data and stuff and whatever, but the main thing is to, you know, to not get distracted and follow your path, follow your truth, and obviously respecting everyone else's rights, and to add your experience and your learning into the collective consciousness, though, you know, so we can all go up a level rather than getting bogged down arguing with each other.
And I feel as well that, I mean, I guess that that we amongst many people I certainly do meet a lot of people who probably couldn't be convinced to agree with a single thing I say, but I've found that is one of the best arenas in which to practice a couple of things. One is staying calm and not allowing your hormones to start raising your voice and talking over people. And the other thing is that it's an excellent situation in which to try formulating questions that are going to, if not illuminate the other person, at least illuminate you as to why they're thinking what they're thinking. It kind of encourages both parties, if you like, to look a little bit closer at their arguments. What do you reckon?
Yeah, absolutely. Asking questions is the best way, isn't it? It's the same with all the Freeman stuff, you know. And if you keep asking the government and that questions, you know, you do start to get somewhere, rather than trying to direct and tell people how things are, you know. But yeah, ask them to tell you. And as you know, and if someone asks you a question, yeah, you have to. When you formulate your reply, you have to really think about what it actually is that you do kind of believe or have found to be true and put it into words. So it makes you clearer on it as well. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. As of course, does even endeavouring to explain things to other people. But, yeah, explanations can actually be given by asking a series of questions. I think it's a great game, and in itself, actually, in difficult circumstances, it can. I certainly find it helps to keep me calm. In the old days, I would have probably got a bit hot under the collar, but I've got to tell you the truth. Nowadays, I meet so many people who don't agree with me that it doesn't really get under my skin at all.
Yeah, likewise, Doctor, and you're dead right. I mean, one of the things we're all here to try and do is to you know, rise a bit and rule our stars. You know, if you study astrology, don't be a sort of ignorant victim of what's going on with the energies, but actually be aware of where they were when you were born. Be aware of what might happen in your life. It's like having a warning or a tip off or a roadmap of things to avoid or routes to go down, you know, that can benefit you. And in doing all that, you know, the aim is to sort of rise above the animal passions, as you say, and to rise above the emotions and not let the emotions control you, but to control the emotions, as you say. And it's not always easy to do, especially earlier in your life. You know, we can all get a bit hot under the collar, but I think if you can get a bit free and get out of, you know, get out of all these debates and arguments and things, and start, if you can start studying a bit of the ancient wisdom like astrology and alchemy and that kind of stuff, hermetic wisdom, you know, that kind of explain really, really well how the universe works, you know, and what God is and how it all hangs together. And then you kind of, you look at that and then you think, well, what does all that other stuff matter? You know, it doesn't matter, does it?
No, quite so. And I remember hearing an astrologer talking at the Green Gathering. I think he's quite a famous one, and he was pointing out that he doesn't like to use astrology effectively as a stick to beat people with. He says what he's doing is introducing people to a toolbox that is available to them and to maybe some pitfalls and stuff. And I think any information you can have in that kind of direction can be taken on board and served to be useful. You've been doing a lot of work with the astrology recently, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I mean, phase seven of my project is what I call astronomology, which is trying to bring back astronomy and astrology back together, you know, from where they split apart. So in doing that, I've got into studying astrology quite a lot, and obviously the calendar, the universal community calendar, that follows the zodiac, you know, from Aries round to Pisces. So I've been looking at, you know, what star signs are versus what constellations are and all of that, and the great year and the sort of the daily cycle and the yearly cycle and the great yearly cycle and all that, and trying to understand the basics of astrology and how it all works. I mean, the question for me always with any of this stuff is why, you know, why why is Mars a malefic planet, you know, and why is the sun the source of spirit and all that kind of thing. And that is very hard. It's very hard with anything you can find sort of on the internet or easily available books. This is quite hard to find the why, because you know, astrology is one of the mysteries, and they're called mysteries because no one actually knows why.
So why do you think it works?
Well, you know, when you can't sort of straight away get the answer why. So, okay, well, let's park that for a minute. So what you do then is you just actually study what the hell everyone is saying that this astrology stuff is, you know. And you, for a moment, you're kind of saying, well, let's just forget the why and accept that, you know, let's just try and understand what they're saying, how it works. And what I found is the older material you look at, the better there, you know. I got a book sort of gifted to me through some friends called Astrology for All by Alan Leo, and it's from 1904, I think, you know, and it's got charts for the 1850s and things for the planets. But I tell you what, I did my birth chart and looked up what that book says about my birth chart, and it's incredible. I mean, it's just ticks all the way through, you know, tick 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 tick. And what I'm thinking of is maybe the bits I haven't ticked, they're just things that haven't happened yet, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, so I've looked at all that. I've looked at you know, the star signs and the constellations and with the difference between the two, and the energies, the fire, the elements, you know, the fire, earth, air, and water, and the qualities, the cardinal, the fixed, the mutable, and all of that stuff, and then the planets, you know, and where the planets fit into it, and you know, in principle, yeah, it does make sense. It makes sense to me that if you're born into matter from spirit on a planet somewhere, and that planet's surrounded by, you know, stars fairly close by with massive gravitational effects and, you know, radiation coming off them, and planets, you know, also large with magnetic fields and all the rest of it, you know, that you're going to be kind of bathed in a soup of different energies, you know, from those sources, and the way that they all overlap and mingle and mix together, you know, it makes sense to me that would affect yourself when you come here, because you know we've got a physical body, a material body, but also a sort of astral body and a spirit body, you know, and all of those things affect each one of those to varying degrees, you know, so. So yeah, I mean, I used to think astrology was a load of rubbish, you know, when I was in my old life, if you like. But the more I've studied it now, I'm an absolute convert, really, because it's if you study it properly, it's very, very accurate. You know, if you just look in the newspaper at your stars, your horoscope for your sun sign, well, you know, forget it. That's not the real thing. But if you do it properly, if you know where, what day and what time and where you were born, and you plug it in and you look where everything was, and then you get a reading for that, you know, you will be amazed how accurate it is. I would recommend everyone to do that, because even if you think it's a load of rubbish, like, what have you got to lose, you know?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, because the same thing happened to me. I was somebody bought for me a birth chart and some writing, and I got kind of 10 pages of handwritten A4 from a lady who'd never met me before, and I learned stuff about myself that I didn't actually know. one of the things she told me that I thought was really interesting and was absolutely down the line, because I'd just escaped from industry at the time. And she said that I had a habit of not losing my temper, and the way I got away with that was by behaving in such a way as to make other people lose theirs. And it had half a dozen things like that in it, which I looked at and I thought, it kind of sends shivers down your spine. And for what it's worth, I mean, I think that what we've got with the astrological signs is, let's face it, pretty random pictures in the sky. Whoever did that dot to dot was a pretty poor artist, and you'd be hard pushed to distinguish what you're looking at. I think that because we're resonant entities, that we're actually sensitive to every single star in the sky, and that they're all, if you like, broadcasting their own electromagnetic signature. It's all moving all the time, which means nobody's born in the same place at the same time, and that we're actually responding to the whole shooting match.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, why wouldn't we? You know, we're one with everything. We're part of everything. So everything's going to affect us to some degree, yeah.
And I think an idea I particularly like about that is that if that makes the cosmos, if you like, a kind of a resonant organ for our learning or our ascension or whatever we want to call it, then with 7,000 million entities being so affected, apparently, on the beautiful ball that we're living on, we're presumably counter-resonant organs for planetary ascension and ascension of the system of which we're a part.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it makes sense, you know, that there is part of the soul's journey that, to ascend, you know, and to ascend up through the levels. And there are others in the past of us who've done that, you know. Maybe one of them was this guy Hermes Trismegistus, you know, and... If you look at Hermetic wisdom, I mean, if you want to, you can get something on YouTube called the Kabbalion and the Emerald Tablets, which has got a good, it's like an audio book, you know, and that's got a good summary of Hermetic wisdom.
Is that the Emerald Tablets attributed to Trismegistus himself as an audio book?
That's the one, yeah. I think they call them the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, because I think, was it the Egyptians called him Thoth, or the...
Yes.
I can't remember, but, you know, Hermes, basically a personification of Mercury.
Yeah, it does have to be said that a lot of the people that we know knew things, people like Pythagoras and stuff, all of them appear to have spent a substantial amount of time in Egypt. Which actually brings us... Lee's asked an interesting question. He's saying, do you know when the first zodiac was came about?
The first zodiac, chart?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, as a kind of, you know, as a study, when's our oldest evidence of people looking at the stars and reaching some general conclusions about what's going on below?
Well, I haven't sort of found anything that says what the first one was, but I think the reason, I don't think you would, because as far as I can see from studying all this, this is wisdom that's been there right through, you know, it's thousands and thousands of years old. So it's not like it started in Chaldea or Babylon or in Egypt or something. It's been there the whole time because our planet, as part of the solar system, rotates through the zodiac, you know, every 24,000 year precessional cycle, you know. So we go through a different age of the zodiac roughly every 2,000 years. And as you said, the constellations, the sort of dot to dot, very few of them look like what they're meant to be, apart from perhaps Leo, you know, is one that does look a bit like a lion.
Just a bit.
If you use your imagination. But that's not the point, you know, because as anyone who studies it will know, the zodiac star signs are, if you like, are named after the constellations, which they align with once every roughly... for about 2,000 years, every 24,000 years, you know. So there's a lot of misunderstanding about that. So,
because what it actually is a projection of a 360-degree circle around the Earth, isn't it, evenly distributed, not the actual position of the stars in the sky. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. So the zodiac star signs that we use in astrology, in Western astrology, as it's called, if you like that, they're fixed. And they're fixed with Aries being the first month, being the first 30 degrees of the ecliptic, starting from the Nobinox, the northbound equinox, or what we in the north call the spring equinox, the one we've just had, which is start a new year in my calendar. From there, Aries and then Taurus and Gemini. And so, you know, they're 30 degree sections of the ecliptic, which are months on Earth. And they're the windows, if you like, through which this, the energy from the sun and the other planets come at certain angles at that time of year, you know. And that month, those 30 days, 30 degrees called Aries, you know, once for 2,000 years or so, every 24,000, that lines up with the constellation Aries, which, you know, is the dots up in the sky, as you're saying, you know, the stars. So if you look up in through this 30 degree window called Aries, you'll see for those 2,000 years or so, you will see the constellation Aries there at that, you know, in that time. But it's moving all the time. So
isn't it kind of weird that the whole thing we're using is itself kind of sliding a bit like the Gregorian year against real time, that you've got this measure which appears to apply to all humans, but that it's not actually cosmically aligned. It sort of is, but it's an algorithm.
Well, what I find is, you know, the Western tropical zodiac, starting with Aries, that stays fixed, that's at a lower level, so that affects individuals on the planet, yeah?
Yeah.
And then the constellations, which are up a level from that, which move, because the constellations actually cycle anti-clockwise as well around the solar system, if you look at it as a fixed solar system. So they go with the shins as well, you know. And so the whole solar system's moving through those constellations over that 24,000 year cycle. And that, you know, one of those is called an age. So we're currently in the age of Pisces still, heading for the age of Aquarius, because, you know, we go backwards through the zodiac there. Yep. And that age, or that where that constellation is, that affects the whole planet. So it depends where you, what level you're at. If you go, maybe just to perhaps help explain, if anyone's online, you want to go to, if you go to projectfreeman.com and then click on phase 5, which is the 9 worlds, there's a couple of slides on there. There's one in particular I'm thinking of that basically shows you what I think, you know, the 9 levels of the material universe, starting with the universe as number 9, going down to a subatomic particle as number 1. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
So, you know, humans, we're like the fifth world in that fractal.
And on that kind of on the basis of that, those concentric circles, I like those because it means that everything within the design is dependent on everything else. If you take out rings 7, then rings 8 and 9 disappear as well.
Yeah. You know. So, if you look at humans being the fifth world and then the planet we live on is like the sixth world, all right? So Western tropical astrology, starting with Aries, you know, which, so it's the months of the year. Aries is the first month, Taurus is the second month, and so on. Those months of the year, the energies, particularly from the sun, the angle we get the energy from the sun at that time of the year, and the tilt of the planet and everything, that affects world 5, you know, humans. And then the constellations, which are all way out, you know, sort of many, many light years away, further away, they affect World 6, the planet, yeah? So it's like a circle within a circle. And if you go to universalcommunitycalendar.com, just go to the calendar homepage and look at the graphic right on the top of the homepage there, you'll see I've got a blue circle showing the Western fixed tropical zodiac, starting with Aries, and then a purple circle around the outside, which is represents the constellations which are moving around that, and so they affect the whole planet, and the Western tropical zodiac, starting with Aries, those star signs, they affect individuals on the planet. So it's two. That's what I'm finding. It's like two different levels. So it's two different levels of the fractal. So again, you know, you'll what they do is they get a big debate going about, well, is Western tropical astrology properly, is that the proper one, or is it Indian? The Indian one is where it moves. That's the right one, you know. And they're both right. The answer is they're both right. There isn't one's better than the other. They're just covering two different things. So that's what I'm finding from my study. And basically the movement of the purple circle on that graphic, that's the great year, you know, that's the processional cycle.
Yeah, it really does look like a Mayan calendar stone set up like that. It's quite good. I noticed you appear to have a great year of about 24,000 years rather than the more generally accepted 26,000. How have you come to that? Am I right there?
You're well spotted, yeah, and I'm glad you asked me that, because I'm writing a bit of a sort of paper on that at the moment. And I'm going to put a blog about it online. But again, if you study this in any great depth, and I call this my procession obsession, which started a few years ago. The currently sort of accepted cycle length is about almost 26,000 years, which is, I think it's about 25,920 or something.
Yeah.
But that's because it's based on the rate of precession that we've got now, which is about 50.3 arc seconds, you know, of circle moved per year. Yeah, but that isn't a constant rate. So what you got to understand is the orbit, if you like. If you imagine the solar system going round this great year is like going round like the Earth going round the sun, yeah?
Yeah.
But instead of the Earth going round the sun, we got the whole solar system rotating around the zodiac.
And yep.
And as you know, if you look at the Earth going around the sun in a year, it's not a fixed rate. Sometimes it's closer to the sun and sometimes the Earth's further away, what they call aphelion and perihelion, yeah?
Yep.
And they happen at opposite sides of the orbit.
So it's kind of speeding up and slowing down effectively from where we're sitting.
Absolutely. It's a slightly elliptical orbit. So the orbit of the Earth's got an eccentricity of about 1.67%. So it's very slightly elliptical. But that, over the course of that yearly orbit, that's enough to make a difference, you know, in the rate that the planet's moving, and therefore the length of time that it would take to go around. Because if the Earth moved at the same rate as it does at perihelion when it's closest to the sun, the year would only be about 354 days long. And if it moved at the rate that it's moving when it's at aphelion, furthest away from the sun, the year would be about 370 days long.
I've actually been reading that that the orbital period of the Earth round the sun has sort of slowed down over time as well, so that we're now getting more days in the year than we used to.
Absolutely. Well, that all ties together. So if you realise that the great year cycle speeds up and slows down as well, you know, we're in the year 13,516 of 24,000. Well, the bottom of the cycle, 12,000 years in, was about 500 AD, and that was when the Romans left.
Whee!
Yeah. Well, you know, it's what we call the Dark Ages. Well, in the Hindu cosmology, in the Yuga cycle, they call it the Kali Yuga, the Greeks called it the Iron Age, and it's known as the Age of Ignorance, you know, and that's where we've come from recently, and we're about 1,516 years now from that point.
Yeah.
And so we're now ascending back towards the Golden Age, as they say, but you know, we've just come past the slowest point of the orbit, if you like. So like the perihelion and aphelion of the Earth's orbit around the sun, you know, the bottom of this cycle was in about 500 AD, so that's the year 12,000 in my calendar. And that's when the rate of precession is the slowest, yeah?
Yeah.
So if at that point the cycle would be about 26,000 years. And because we're past that point now, the cycle's gone down to about 25,920. And as we get nearer back to when we're closest to the center of the Milky Way, which is at the other end of the cycle, what they call the Golden Age, you know, the last time that happened was, as I say, 13,500 years ago. And then the rate of precession is much quicker, and you get a cycle length much shorter and less than 24,000 years. But on average, it's 24,000 years. Like, right. On average, there's 365 days in the year.
And all of those movements round and about are going to change the actual stresses and frequencies that are operating on the solar system itself. So the whole stack of frequencies must be changing relative to each other.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Like gears,
yeah. And, the Younger theory is that as we get closer to the center of the galaxy, we pick up more beneficial cosmic radiation, and our consciousness elevates, and it turns on more DNA in our bodies and all the rest of it. And as we move away from it, that goes down, you know. So again, that makes sense to me that consciousness is a cycle as well as everything else, because everything in this fractal universe that we live in is cyclical. You know, nothing is linear.
No. No, and there's a duality to it all as well. There's over here and over there. There's the fastest and the slowest and the closest and the furthest away and all of that. Here's a good question from Lee.
Right.
Right. He's put, here's the conundrum. You need a feckin' good telescope to see any planets in the sky, and you may see the circle of animals brightly lit, but you need planets in your chart against the backdrop of the zodiac to make these interpretations. They didn't have telescopes back then. Just to fill that in a little bit, I think Laurie put in there that the Greeks got their astrology from the Mesopotamians, who got it from the Sumerians. And I think there's plenty of evidence that the Sumerians actually knew about certainly Neptune and Uranus, even though I think even with a telescope you'd be hard pushed to see them. So what do you make of that?
Well, absolutely, and they're all in Greek mythology as well. So how did the Greeks know about them? You know. I don't kind of go with this linear sort of evolution kind of theory, if you like, that seems to be quite accepted by most people.
Yeah. And Neo-Darwinian synthesis.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, evolution within within species makes sense, but evolution from one species to another doesn't really. And evolution, I'm sure, is cyclical like everything else. So what Lee's saying there about the telescopes and what you can, which planets you can see and all the rest of it. Yeah, we know there's five visible planets, but these ancient civilizations, as you say, knew about the others, even though in theory they shouldn't know about them because you can't see them, you know. So how did they know about them? Well, I think the answer to that is because, you know, if you go back through this precessional cycle of the great year, you know, we're not the end of a linear progression where we're the most advanced. We're far from that. You know, we're much less advanced than people before us in the previous bronze and silver and gold ages have been, and will be again, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's only fair to point out that we can now definitely see that we've forgotten some pretty major things, because I'm aware that several people before Nought AD, shall we say, were well aware that the Earth revolved around the Sun. We'll call it that. We know it actually tugs along behind it, but and yet, come 1700 AD, Galileo was getting into all sorts of trouble for even suggesting such a thing. So the idea seems to have gone out of fashion. Like,
yeah, well, you know, 1700 is, that's the date when the Kali Yuga ended and the Bronze Age, the Dwapara Ascending Yuga started in the Hindu theory. Or, like you say, the Bronze Age in the Greek. So, and that, you know, if you look at the history there that we all get taught, that's what they called the Renaissance, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess it was. So are we on the up and up now in terms of this big cycle?
Absolutely, yeah. As far as I can see from everything I've studied, we're definitely rising in consciousness. There's more and more people waking up and becoming aware of what God is and what the universe is and how it all works, and the fact is it's mental, you know, it works like a mind. I got a question for you to ponder on, which we can talk about later.
Yeah.
Which I asked my mates recently. Does Eleanor Rigby exist? All right, so I think, don't answer me yet, but I'll I'll come back to you on that one.
Well, I'll tell you what, shall we have a 10-minute music break and a comfort break whilst we think about whether Eleanor Rigby exists. So I could put on a couple of tunes. There was a funny thing that Mahatma Coates put in the chat box earlier. He put, "You've all been had. The Earth is in fact not spherical but rectangular." And then Lee's put in, "Excellent, altar shaped. Now it all makes sense."
Yeah, no, it's triangular. I'm a triangulist.
Right. Yes, I had indeed heard.
I don't believe all these rectangulists. They're all wrong, you know.
It's a trapezoid. We're all living on a pyramid.
Well, as far as I can see, we're all living in a beautiful spiral fractal of sacred geometry. So that's what I'm into. And when you resonate with that and start projecting it out again, you know, I think it all kind of goes up. So
yeah,
let's think about that. And
okay, we'll have a 10-minute music break. We'll leave people thinking about whether Eleanor Rigby really exists, and then they can also think about Lee's latest question, which is, would a flat Earth make astrology useless? You need circles for cycles. Can flat Earth do that? So there we go. That's plenty for you to think about. I'm just going to fish my way back to my broadcaster, which is, and see if we can't stick on a couple of kicking tunes. I'm going to play "Do Anything You Want to Do" by Eddie and the Hot Rods, because it sounds like what you're doing, Litmus, and we'll come back to them in 10 minutes or so. Is that all right with you?
Sweet. Play the tunes, man.
Brilliant. There we go. That was Tracy Curtis, "All the Girls Love a Soldier." I love that Tracy Curtis. She likes a really nice song. Before that, bit of local colour from Mid Wales, the Tango Band playing "Piri Piri" off their Deja Vu album. And before that, as correctly spotted by Sean Maguire, our very own resident punk, "Do Anything You Want to Do" by Eddie and the Hot Rods. And now I'm rejoined on the line by Litmus A. Freeman from projectfreeman.com. You still with us, Litmus?
Yep, all good.
Absolutely brilliant. It's looking cracking here. So let's kick off to the mystery question that you left for us before we had a bit of a break there, and about does Eleanor Rigby exist? You see a comment from Nick Nomic in the chat box saying she might have existed, but being one of the I've lost it now. Hang on, I'll find this chat box a little bit difficult to steer when I'm. Eleanor Rigby may have existed, but wasn't observed as one of the lonely people. She could have fallen over in a forest, and no one would have cared. Does he score points for that?
He certainly does with this Beatles fan here for knowing the lyrics, yeah.
Yeah. I'd say that she kind of exists in as much as anything else does, because she's quite a clear idea in my mind because of the song that was written about her, and most other things seem to actually share about that amount of reality, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head, mate, as always. The reason I asked that question is just sort of linked to what we've been talking about hermetic wisdom, you know, as above, so below, and all the astrology and alchemy stuff. I kind of realized that, if you've had a look at anything like, to do with hermetic wisdom, the fact that, it suggests that the universe is mental, you know, it's like a big mind. So like the universe is a creation in the mind of God, if you like. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it, if you like, does Eleanor Rigby exist? Well, yeah, of course she does, because in her universe, her God is called Paul McCartney, because he created her, yeah?
Yeah.
And he brought her into being through the power of his imagination. So there's a universe that exists in Paul McCartney's mind, with him being God, where Eleanor Rigby is one of the inhabitants of that universe, yeah?
Yeah.
As is Father McKenzie. And all the lonely people. Now, there's anyone on our planet who's heard Eleanor Rigby has a parallel universe in their mind, which is very similar. It has a character called Eleanor Rigby and one called Father McKenzie and the lonely people and all the rest of it. But, you know, my picture of what Eleanor Rigby looks like and your picture of what Eleanor Rigby looks like might be slightly different. But they're very like parallel universes, because they're both aware of this knowledge and the fact that these people, these characters exist. But they're all just slightly different. So I think, you know, and that's how our material universe works. So it's an imagination. It's a creation. Everything in it is a creation in the mind of whoever the creator is, or whatever the creator is, you know, the mental energy and projection. So anyone on our planet who hasn't heard Eleanor Rigby, in their universe, in their mind, she doesn't exist. But anyone who's heard the song, she does. So, you know, our creator is called the creator or God or whatever, because we don't know what it is, but Eleanor Rigby's God is Paul McCartney. Does that make sense?
That all makes sense to me, and everything we see around us is similarly spoken into existence.
Yeah, and I absolutely find now that, you know, be careful what you think about, because thoughts become actions, you know, and you do definitely affect what manifests in reality through the power of your thought and your desires and all the rest of it. So if we all get bogged down arguing with each other and watching lots of kind of nasty documentaries and stuff about how we're all going to be controlled by the global machine, you know, and we're not going to have any freedom and it's going to be a police state, that's what will happen. But if we don't, if we project what I see, you know, of lots of nature and back to community and sharing and looking after each other and doing good things and living in the sunlight and living in the cycles of nature, that's the world we'll manifest. So the more of us that can do that, the better.
Yeah, I quite agree. And I mean, it seems to be fairly widely acknowledged that whereas Einstein might have thought that the whole thing was simply matter and energy, we now know it is matter and energy and consciousness. And it's not, I don't think it's necessarily a democratic system. I think it might be a republic. I think it might be possible that all of those people who believe that there is going to be an apocalypse and that that's what they're anticipating, then that's what they're going to find themselves in. Whereas the ones who are concentrating on the bright white light of a new conception are perhaps going to experience that. I do envisage, though, that we all end up, as I've said, at the same after-production party.
Yeah, but, you know, we can affect it. And I'm not saying we should ignore what's going on or live in a sort of la-la wonderland where we pretend it's not happening or something. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking definitely, you know, being aware of what they're doing, but not getting all scared and thinking, oh, shit, you know, that we're all done for, you know, because then we'll be, you know.
I think to a certain extent it must be true to say that we're all working hard at embodying the solution as a result of our understanding to some extent the challenge, and that if you
I think so. And yeah, go on, mate.
Yeah, indeed. So before we knew about the problems we faced, we were sort of part of them. So I think it is a kind of a, if you like, looking at things askance, like one's supposed to do in lucid dreaming, where you allow your eyes to kind of flicker on and off it, as it were, and be aware of its presence, but concentrate fully on what it is that you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, and, you know, in Plato's allegory of the cave, don't just keep watching the shadows on the wall, you know.
Yeah, indeed. Get out the cave. So
get out the cave and see what's really going on, you know. And you don't really know much of anything other than what you've really actually experienced yourself. You know, that's this common ground that me and my brother got to when we were arguing in the past. You know, was we can agree on the fact that really the only thing you can kind of think you know for sure is something you've got experience of. So on all the other stuff you get told about is going on and you know, third party this and, you know, whatever, you don't, half the time, you don't really know if it's true or not, and it can just be a big distraction. So
sometimes I find it hard to know whether what's happening to me is true.
Yeah, well, you shouldn't smoke so much, mate.
So how's it been for you getting out of Plato's cave then? How goes the free the body thing?
Yeah, really, really good. The body is very, you know, very, very free. I just wanted to mention a couple of things in terms of that. You know, I have noticed over year there has been a bit of a clamping down on sort of freedom and movement, if you like, down in the Algarve. So there's a couple of less places to stop, and a few more signs up. And
what do the signs threaten you with, as a matter of interest?
Well, that's the difference. They don't threaten you with anything. They just say, for example, a couple of places we used to sort of wild camp in the last few years, have now got a sign up, you know, with a camper van and a no parking sort of sign. And some of them say from 8 in the evening to 8 in the morning, you know, but some of them don't even say that. But they don't actually say anything about a penalty or any, you know, any fines or anything if you ignore them or anything, you know. And we still pretty much find that you can still park it in places without any hassle.
Yeah, indeed. So you're not actually attracting any attention. So the slight restriction on freedom of the movement is at the moment apparent, do you think, rather than real?
Well, is it, like I say, there's a little bit more, because, you know, they're clamping down everywhere, but down here you didn't really notice it so much. But there's a little bit more of that. But what I find generally is if you don't take the piss, you're fine. So yeah. if you don't go down the beach and get all your washing out and all the toys all over the place and dogs running around and leave your rubbish everywhere, you know, it's fine. But as soon as you go in the woods or something, start hanging washing up and that, if the cops go by, they're going to ask you to move on, and fair enough, you know, because the woods look nice as they are, you know, and there's ways of drying your washing, like, without hanging them up between two lovely trees in a nice part of the wood. So, you know, if they think, you know, that bit of land, so-called, is owned by the local authority or whatever, they might move you on. But generally, you can pretty much camp anywhere, and like you say, as long as you don't take the mickey and you respect the place. This is a national park, don't forget.
Yeah.
You know, it's like going into Brecon Beacons or the Lake District or something and wild camping. You imagine that?
Yeah, I can imagine how that would work. A friend of mine who basically moves around as a result of the way he's kind of keeping himself busy nowadays, he occasionally finds himself sleeping in his car, and he woke up the other day to find 3 or 4 carloads of policemen round him, claiming that somebody, and there'd been a few burglaries, and somebody had seen a guy sleeping in a black car. So he got the full treatment. They let him go and everything like that once they chatted to him, but it's not a very nice way of waking up.
No, of course not. But I tell you what, in all the years of travelling, it's a shame for him, but I've been lucky that, you know, I've only literally been asked to move once, and that was a few weeks ago by a couple of state police, and it's just because we made the mistake of hanging some washing up, basically.
Right, so you've just got to know what the sub rules, what the bylaws are.
Well, you know, I don't know if it's that so much, but down here, it's just, as far as I'm concerned, the cops are cool. You know, they don't, they're not nasty, they're not aggressive. They leave you be as much as possible. If it gets to the stage where there's one of the beaches here, it's called Barranco, it's like the sort of the main hippie beach where everyone goes to party and stuff. And it gets a bit out of hand down there every now and again. So every now and again, the cops go in and move everyone off, and then they gradually all sort of drift back and start again. They go around the cycle, you know. There's another cycle. It's like the moving and coming back cycle.
You know? So have you got a kind of community of people who are moving about? Do you get to see people in different places and hang out with them and stuff? Are there a lot of you? Aha, looks like you might have dropped away again. Perhaps we might have to
end.
Yeah, indeed. Sorry, we lost you there completely for a minute. I was just asking you whether there's a lot of people moving around, whether you've got a kind of community that you run into regularly.
Yeah, can you hear me now all right?
Yes, can, yeah, you're coming through clear now.
Okay, yeah, so, yeah, definitely. There's loads of different spots, different beaches, different sort of areas in the woods and whatever, where people hang out in vans and meet up and socialise and share information. And, it's great, you know. And there's new little communities springing up all the time. There's a girl down here who's been left some land, and has kind of said to everyone, if you're traveling through, come and hang out. And we have, you know, have music jam nights there and stuff like that. And, you know, people sharing what they got, basically. And there's little communities springing up in what they call Hippie Valley, which is quite near here, where people are getting together and getting bits of land and growing crops and stuff on them. So, yeah, so, you know, it's starting to happen. But the main thing is if you're all sort of individually living in your vans and traveling around, it's a very nice spot to be. And, There's if you want to be on your own, there's places you can be on your own, like I am at the moment. And if you want to socialise, there's places you can go and socialise. So
these little places sound a little bit like free festivals if people are turning up and sharing food and playing music and stuff like that. It sounds like the good old days.
Yeah, well, you know, without too much organisation, it's just, I think, like, unfortunately still, of course, we have to use the Gregorian calendar. So it's always on a Thursday night that the music jam happens, you know, for example. But, you know, outside of that, people drop in and out all the time. But, I mean, I haven't actually been to that music jam yet because I've always been doing something else. Like tonight, I'm doing this, so...
Thursday night's popular night.
Yeah, it seems to be. But you know, I've found that all over Europe traveling, there's a whole community of people, transient, and even if they're not living on the road all year round, they're going back to their home, sort of country, as you say, and working a bit and getting some tokens together so they can come away for winter and live on the beach in the van, you know.
Yeah. And we were talking about the gaming tokens earlier on. How's the kind of euro debt and stuff affecting your lifestyle? Is it seeing, because I gather that the Swiss unpegged their currency from the euro or something recently, and that that it's not worth so much as it was. Is it kind of visible on the ground? Or you've gone all quiet again? Don't know whether you can hear me. Presumably,
yeah. I heard about that and something about not issuing euros and cash points. Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah.
Something about not issuing euros in cash points, really.
Yeah, I heard something about that in Switzerland, I think. But yeah, I mean the whole euro debt scam, you know. And again, there's a bit of a blog on Part One of Project Free Man about the euro debt scam. But you see it all the time if you travel around Europe. I mean, down here at what you see is them spending on totally unnecessary kind of superficial so-called improvements. Like, you know, there's areas where they're just putting sort of new car parks and wooden like walkways on just open ground on the cliffs near the beach, you know, which are totally unnecessary. And they're just trying to kind of tap the thing up and make it look a bit nicer. But, you know, they're meant to be really poor and up to their eyes in debt, and yet, you know, this one I'm mentioning in Sagres, for example, this little bit of work that's going on there, that's about 80,000 euro, you know, and there's a couple of them that are running into millions, and of course it's all being borrowed as euro debt, and all has to be paid back with interest, and all the people have to pay tax to pay that interest on it. So I think the euro debt scam's alive and well, and of course is keeping people kind of busy, keeping them employed, doing unnecessary jobs, so that they don't actually kind of get free and realize what they should be doing and follow their own path, you know. So you see a lot of that, and particularly in Spain, you know, we might have mentioned this before, but like loads of road building, you know, like three roads running together next side by side, you know, all going to the same place in various degrees of finish. So yeah, lots of euro debt spending.
Yeah, I see the same thing happening over here. We were in Aberystwyth recently, and there's some sort of huge project underway. We looked at it; it's a massive hole in the ground, and kind of new big seawall. And there's like gotta be eight or ten of these containers and a huge crane, and it's massive. You know, we were sitting by the cafe having a cup of coffee, and we asked the lady in the cafe what it was for, and she said, "Oh, they're rebuilding the bandstand," and I don't know how often the bandstand gets used, but at the same time, the county councils around here are kind of shutting public toilets and cutting off Meals on Wheels, and you can't help wondering how much more useful stuff could have been done. And a lot of what I'd call cosmetic work, we saw that happening in Blackpool, which is in a really sad state. You know, the town's full of really amazing people as far as we can tell, but it looked like something out of a sci-fi movie, but they were spending a fortune on the seafront.
Yeah, well, exactly, and you see it everywhere. You know, I mean, in Ipswich recently, they redid the whole of the town centre, which was kind of fine before, and changed all the traffic around, put loads of these paving slabs everywhere, And it's meant to be a time of austerity, you know, so it's crazy. They're telling you one thing on one hand, and then, as you say, spending on all these kind of superficial cosmetic kind of things whilst cutting out essential services. So just basically taking a piss, you know.
Well, I guess once again, they're kind of doing our job for us, because as the disparity between what's being claimed and what's actually being done becomes ever clearer, as things like this do tend to reveal, then more people are going to start asking questions, I'm sure, eventually.
Absolutely, especially, you know, if you just step back and look at it and think for yourself for a bit, you inevitably start asking questions, don't you? Yeah.
Yeah. So the free the body thing's working absolutely fine as long as you don't hang out your washing.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
It's like, good morning, Vietnam. And what about the free in the mind? You're evidently still getting plenty of time to write songs and to do research and things like that. How's your trip from surf to self coming along?
Yeah, really good, thanks, mate. I think last time we spoke, we did a bit of a show where we ran through Surf to Self, which is, you know, as people might remember, is like a little guide to how to get free kind of thing, how to get from being a surf to being your true spiritual self. But at the time I only had the audio of that, but since we last spoke, I've edited all the video and put the video online. So if you go to projectfreeman.com and go to phase 4, you see the link at the top of the page there, phase 4 Surf to Self. You'll see all the YouTube vids of that sort of presentation, and each bit includes a song as well. So and then on the page, I put some links to a lot of the information that I mention in the presentation as well. So, you know, people might find that helpful. Bit more stuff to check out. Might help them on their path a bit.
I must admit, your website's looking really amazing. It's got new stuff on it every time I go there.
Yeah, it's getting there. I still haven't even... The sort of part 3, the spirit stuff, phases, sort of 7, 8, 9... I haven't even done the pages for them yet. You can imagine I got so much material. It's, because it's a hell of a big topic area. So it's just, you know, if you look at my astrology, I'm a pretty strong Gemini. And so lots of sort of, mental, you know, and sort of, interest, you know, a lot in the mind. And it's certainly, you know, in terms of liking to start things and maybe not so good at finishing them off. So I really have to kick myself up the ass sometimes to sort of stop writing new songs and researching new stuff and actually load up some of the stuff I've already found. You know?
Yeah, to a certain extent, you've got to get the new perspective fairly rounded before you can actually do that. You've got to kind of know where you're going before you can actually set about getting there, I find, with internet projects.
Yeah, that's it. So I've put the framework there, so hopefully people who are following it can see where we're going. And I will get round at some point to load in some more stuff up. But I'm fairly happy with sort of parts 1 and 2 are pretty much up to date. There's a whole load of more stuff on phase 5, the 9 worlds of the base 3 universe. I mean, lots. But it's basically all material and showing that we are in a sort of fractal, you know, in a fractal structure and as above, so below. So I might end up just maybe posting some links and stuff and some graphics on there about that. But yeah, part 2's pretty good. And of course, out of part 2 came phase 6 was in there, which was about breaking free the control of consciousness from clocks and calendars and constellations, you know, some of what we've been talking about earlier. So The Universal Community Calendar came out at work, so that's taking a lot of my internet time now, because I've done quite a lot of work on the UCC website as well. So you can get calendar converters from Gregorian to UCC, you know, circular ones and tabular ones, and it's got a date calculator, and it explains all the months and the great year and everything. So, you know, if you're into calendrics or just natural cycles at all, have a look at that. You might find some useful stuff there.
I think the thing I like about that, I meant to check it out before I came on tonight, but I didn't really get time, and that's, I really like the feature which tells you how many days you've been around. I think that's really nice, that.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, if if anyone wants to do that, if you go to the universalcommunicalendar.com and website and click on date calculator, and you'll see a little date calculator there. It'll show you the day that it is today in both calendars. And then you can, if you put your birthday in and click apply, it'll tell you how many days minus it is, so how many days you've been here.
Yeah, oh, that's really cool. I'm just having a quick go at that. I remember it was quite.
So you can see it's the 4th of 1 Aries today.
Yeah, I can see that.
March in a Gregorian. Yeah, so if you can put your birthday in either in Gregorian or in UCC. I'm guessing you only know it in Gregorian.
Yeah, they're quite. Provided by Mick the Moon, the same man that provides the Mayan date calculator on my site. I remember
that. Yeah, well, you guys put me in touch with Mick. Thanks for that. He's done a great job, and he did my circular calendar converter as well. So if you want to have a look at that, that's on where it see the Gregorian converters.
Yeah,
I think. So you click on there, and you got last year, current year, and next year.
Yep. He's also,
If you look at current year, circular landscape layout color.
Yep.
Middle there. If you click on that, you'll get a round graphic which draws itself out around the year.
Brilliant. I bet he really enjoyed doing that work. He's also really hot on how the planets and the stars work, our Mick. He's one of these people who can actually explain it to you.
Yeah, brilliant, eh?
Yeah. There you go. It says I'm 19,745 days old.
Yeah, there you go. Nice one, mate.
Excellent. Makes me feel a lot more mature, that does.
Well, it's interesting when you look at it in days, isn't it? Because I'm 18,907 days on the planet today, apparently.
Just a youngster then.
Yeah, whippersnapper compared to you, mate.
So I know, what do you think? I guess my guess is, because as you know, we've kind of unlocked from quite a lot of the system to the extent that we can. And one of the things I've noticed is that because the days aren't kind of forced into an habitual pattern, sometimes we make it out at one point, sometimes at another, we're just as likely to be found working over a weekend or not working during the week as we are the other way round. I find that one of the things that it makes me more aware of is the I don't know, environmental hints, synchronicities, little things. You seem to be more aware of things that are changing around you. Would you have found that?
Yeah, absolutely, all the time. Things like that, and because you kind of just go in with how you feel and what you like doing and what you're drawn to. So I think there's some energy stuff there. There's some positive energies attracting you in a certain direction, and when you go in that direction, then all the synchronicities kick in. So you run into someone you didn't expect to, and you end up going to some other place, and you meet someone there, and they tell you something else you didn't know, and so it goes on, and it happens more and more. Whereas when you kind of think, well, whatever I feel like doing today, I got to get up and go to work or whatever, you kind of taken out of that natural flow, and you don't see those opportunities, and you don't meet those people, and you don't get that info. And the freer you can get of the calendar control, the better, really. You still there?
Yes, indeed, yeah. You just faded out there, but I think you were saying the freeing from the calendar control is really important. And I'd say...
I found, because we had the eclipse the other day. All right, you getting me?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, you're back again.
it's the dongle, mate. We'll blame Vodafone, eh?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, it's doing pretty much. It's doing all right. I must admit, it's we're hearing most of you. We are.
Yeah, let's not blame anyone then. Let's be positive. Let's give lots of love to the dongle. Great dongle, I love you, dongle.
Well, it'd be pretty hard to do what you're doing without it. same with me. My dongle's a pretty valuable piece of tackle doing these things.
I think most people's dongles are pretty important to them. Yeah, but I think what I was getting with the eclipse is we were talking about the calendar and stuff, but because we had the eclipse the other day on New Year's Eve in my calendar, on the day, on Nabonok's day, the day of the northbound equinox in the morning, we experienced that down here, and it was very much like the kind of the slate being wiped clean, you know. So I think if anyone's been having any tough times or anything, not only have they got the sort of plus energies of spring coming in now, they've also got the sort of symbolic wiping of the slate clean by the eclipse, you know, and it's like a fresh start, a new beginning.
Yeah, and the eclipse, of course, is...
Hello,
can you hear me? Hello, we gone again, Litmus. I wonder if we should try...
Yeah,
you can hear me. Yeah, the eclipse always makes me realise that we're dealing with something that, as far as I know, is probably pretty unique to our solar system, because the fact that the moon slots exactly over the sun like that is a bit spooky.
Oh, isn't it? Yeah, and of course it's just a coincidence.
Yes, one hell of a coincidence that one is.
Maybe does that kind of lead us on to this moving to Mars bit?
Yeah, I think so, because I'd like to, before we finish, I'd like to return to some of the things that have been said in the chat box, and there's been quite a lot of discussion of the planets moving and things like that. What have you discovered about Mars?
Well, you know, you very kindly lent me your Velikovsky book, The Worlds in Collision,
yes,
a year or so back.
Yeah, cracking
read. You know, we've talked about that before, and that's really fascinating stuff and so well put together. I got a lot of time for the whole concept, you know, and I guess with that in mind, whilst I've been studying astrology, and in particular lately, I've been looking at the symbols for the planets, because really with astrology we got to get away from the words and the names, because they're all different, you know, in different languages. I mean, the name for Aries is different in Hindi and English and Latin and Greek and all the rest of it, but the symbol is the same, you know. The symbols, you know, is the same as they've been for thousands of years, and the symbol really represents the planet rather than the name. And I started a little blog about this. So in particular, the moving of Mars. So I was looking at the symbol for Mars. So if you want to have a look at that blog, just to get a bit of background, if you go to the top of the universalcommunitycalendar.com website, you see I've just put in their latest blog, The Moving of Mars.
Yeah,
So you can click on that and just see what I'm saying about it there, and there's a couple of links and stuff. But basically, the planetary symbols, they're made up, there's three components to them, yeah? So anyone who knows about astrology will know this, but the circle stands for spirit, and the half circle stands for sort of soul, mind, and then you got the cross, the solar cross, which represents matter. So, If you look at Mercury, he's got the half circle of soul above the circle of spirit with the cross of matter below. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So that's because Mercury is positive and negative. He's hermaphrodite, and he's got all elements in him, and he's close to the sun. If you look at Venus is the circle of spirit above the cross of matter.
Yeah.
And she's the negative pair of the her and Mars being the positive side of that. And so Mars is meant to be the opposite of Venus. So the symbol is for Mars is the cross of matter over the circle of spirit. So you would expect it to be a cross with a circle on the top, but it's not, you know, it's a circle with a sort of arrow pointing off at 45 degrees. And if you look at the arrowhead, it's exactly half of a solar cross. If you cut a solar cross diagonally in half, you'll get an arrowhead.
Yep.
And I just thought, well, why isn't the symbol just the Venus one upside down, you know? Maybe the symbol's actually trying to communicate something about what's happened to the planet. I mean, who knows, but it's just an idea. So maybe half of Mars's mass or something has been removed at some point. So instead of the full cross, it's only got half of it. And maybe the planet has moved in position. So instead of being a straight line up, it's off at 45 degrees.
Of course, Velikovsky does argue that it took a hell of a pummeling in some close encounters with what he thought was Venus, didn't he?
Yeah, when Venus was a comet, before it settled into a circular orbit.
This is one of the questions that I'd have for Velikovsky, really, is that it seems, again, as we were discussing earlier, that the Sumerians, they were aware of Uranus and Neptune by whatever means, but they were aware of Venus as well, and that was a good, because Velikovsky's timing's a bit odd, because he puts it at something like 1500 AD, does he? Or was it 1500 BC? Can't remember, it's a while since
I read it. No, I think he's, yeah, it's when his one big event with Venus is 1500 BC, yeah, BCE. In the Gregorian,
which is kind of at least 1800 years after the first or one of the earliest written records of it. So I'm wondering whether his timing was wrong, because I'm pretty sure that I had the feeling that he was right about Venus, but there's something a little bit amiss about the thing, I thought.
Yeah, well, I think he does allude to an earlier occurrence as well.
Yeah,
and then later occurrence sort of maybe much nearer. Year one, if you like, when Mars was involved.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, so with that in mind, I just wonder if there's some clues in the symbology of Mars as to the fact that maybe it has been moved and it has had some of its matter removed. And then a couple of days after kind of thinking about this, I saw a post online that says, scientists now believe that Mars lost half of its surface in a big collision. and I saved the link for that, but between now and then, my old laptop crashed and I lost all my bookmarks and I had to get into them. So,
well, it's certainly true that that Mars has got two distinctly different surfaces to it. I know that the Thunderbolts people at the Electric Universe Project show that, the one half of it is like, the whole surface has been electrostatically machined. They do a bit of that work in the laboratory and show what happens when a high voltage electrical charge is passed over damp wood or metal or whatever, and then take a microscope picture of it and show you that that's exactly what half of Mars looks like. I think the suggestion is, isn't it, that they didn't actually collide, but that there was a huge discharge of some sort which kind of blew it all away.
Yeah, well, I mean what Velikovsky says is a electrical discharge from Venus to Mars. Well, if the concept of them being positive and negative is true, then that would make sense, wouldn't it? And this scientific paper, I've got to find this again and then post it into the blog, but it said that the southern half of Mars was very different to the top, the northern half of Mars, and that I think most of the northern part could have been lost in this near miss or collision or whatever it was. So,
yeah.
But I think, I think basically there's maybe some clues in the symbols. And so possibly it's the same thing applies to Jupiter and Saturn, because Jupiter's symbol is the semicircle of soul above the cross of matter. So you would expect it to be, a semicircle, upside, you know, a curve with a cross underneath it. But it's actually, if you know the symbol for Jupiter, it looks like a bit like a number four. Where the semicircle is on its side, and then the cross is kind of plonked onto the edge of it, kind of thing. So, and I wasn't sure if maybe they were just trying to make it look like a four because Jupiter's the fourth of the visible planets, you know, and then the symbol for Saturn looks a bit like a number five in some ways it's drawn, and that's the fifth planet, you know. So, but again, Saturn is the opposite of Jupiter. So instead of the semicircle above the cross, it's the cross above the semicircle. So you'd expect to see a cross sitting on top of a semicircle upside down, but you don't. You see a sort of cross standing up with a kind of wiggly part semicircle stuck on the edge of it. So again, that symbol doesn't really do what it's meant to say. So
you think do you think the symbols maybe recalling the kind of catastrophic history that we see reported by many of our predecessors?
Yeah, I think they might be. You know, that's why I wanted to just put something, like, publish something about it, really. Because yeah, who knows? I mean, if we had a symbol for something nowadays and then it changed dramatically for some reason, we probably wouldn't keep the same graphic or symbol. We'd probably reflect something in it to show what had happened, and I think that's maybe what's happened here.
That's what symbols are for, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's funny though, because there was a comment in the chat box earlier that was suggesting that one of the reasons why older races might have been able to do a bit of astrology was because perhaps the planets were closer to us in those days, which is, I know Velikovsky touches on that, and certainly the Thunderbolts people do. And that suggests that, because at the moment, of course, Orthodox theory would have us believe that all of the planets came into existence at about the same time, about 3,800 million years ago or whatever, and that they've been there happily orbiting on the ecliptic ever since. But even our calendars suggest that basically the planets are moving further away from the sun and taking longer to go round it over time.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, coming back to this great year cycle we talked about earlier, I think those things vary around that cycle as well. So, you know, things speed up and slow down at various parts of various cycles, and they all sort of overlap in some way. And it's just fascinating stuff when you start looking into it, trying to piece it. It's like trying to piece an old jigsaw together, you know, where you've, you know, you maybe had a move and drop the box down the stairs and all the pieces are falling out, and you're trying to find them all and put them back together, you know.
Well, we do tend to, one of the things that we seem to be taught to assume is kind of a steady evolution and no significant change over time. But just the conversation we've had this evening suggests that the radical change really is, well, certainly subtle change, and in some cases radical change, is pretty much the order of the day. It's far more what we need to be considering and talking about, because all change is opportunity.
Yeah, and I think you can see all the changes that must have occurred if you start to look at the solar system, and you know, Mars looks to me as if it should be between Mercury and Venus, the size of it, you know, not where it is now, and you know, our moon is so big, and as you say, the coincidence of it exactly fitting over the sun is amazing. In the asteroid belt, which as far as I can see seems obvious to be the remnants of a destroyed planet, like in Star Wars, you know.
Yeah.
You've got a perfect object called Ceres there, you know, which I use as a symbol to represent that day of the week, if you like, that orbit of the sun. And, you know, that don't really make sense. So there's all sorts of theories, you know, that there was a planet there. Some say it was called Tiamat or whatever. And two of its moons, you know, one was our moon and the other one was Ceres, and Ceres is still there in the asteroid belt, and we captured our moon, you know, and Mars and Venus were involved, and maybe Jupiter and Saturn, and, you know, there's probably all sorts of stuff that's gone down, you know, that we can't really be sure of, but it seems obvious just looking at it that it isn't just this fixed kind of static solar disk that all the planets kind of came out of and are still in the same place. That don't really make sense to me.
No, I think I'd far sooner run with the theory that planets give birth to planets. I love the idea that originally there was just the sun and one planet, and bit by bit their interactions ensured that other planets were born, and each time that occurred there'd be a fair degree of chaos as things settled down.
Yeah, and you know, and again, the astrology, independently, if you just study astrology and you happen to have read Velikovsky, you start noticing things that kind of fit. Like he says that, you know, Venus that became a comet possibly came out of Jupiter. And then if you look at the astrology and the polarities of the different planets, you know, you've got a sympathy between Venus and Jupiter, like you've got between Mars and Saturn, you know. So, there's some stuff there that kind of supports what you're saying, you know.
And certainly the Greek and Roman myths suggest that Venus sprung from the head of Jupiter.
Yeah, so, you know, all these myths, so-called myths, are just really seem to be allegories and stories to preserve the knowledge through times when it's all being destroyed in ignorance, you know.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, there was another comment in the chat box which said that the ancient Greeks saw a different sky from what we see, and that the mythology that's come down to us is basically a record of what the sky is doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah. Well, and if you feel some information is at threat and books are going to be burned, what you do? You make up stories and pass them word of mouth to preserve the knowledge.
And it certainly seems that that's had to happen many times in the past.
Yeah, and I think all that's there for us to to dig through and sort of work backwards and try and figure out what they were actually saying that led to that story, you know. And I think we're seeing some of that in the astrology.
It would certainly seem, wouldn't it, that that orthodoxy, as ever, is hell bent on maintaining some kind of stranglehold on the history of the solar system, which is pretty much denied by all the ancient records, as far as I can tell, and a lot of them were pretty careful sky watchers.
Oh yeah, I mean they a lot more than most of us are today. You know, has anyone looked outside tonight while we've been on air? I don't know. But the moon, you know, the moon's just gone into Cancer and looking nice little crescent there. You know, in the just sort of just left Gemini, the star sign, of course, which is pretty much got the constellation of Taurus in it, of course, because of where we are in the great year processional cycle. But you know, I again encourage everyone to look up at the night sky as much as possible, you know, and out and just let it all pour into you and feel all those energies and look at all that wonder, you know. And it's a great thing to do, just to sort of elevate your consciousness a bit just from doing that, you know.
I think seeing the stars is an amazing thing. A lot of the places we spend our time are really dark enough to enjoy them to the full. And I recently downloaded Stellarium as well, which I found to be extremely easy to use when I want to know, because I don't know the names for many of these things. And every now and then it's useful not just to gape in wonder, I guess.
Oh, absolutely, mate. You know, I'm a big fan of Stellarium. You'll find the UCC websites full of Stellarium shots.
Yes. Yeah, indeed, a very good they are. So basically, we're concluding that that things are waking up, the cosmos is changing, that where we've been isn't necessarily going to be where we're going to end up.
Yeah, man. You know, it's very positive if we go with that flow and look at things positively and project mentally what we want to see and start acting it and doing it. You know, we can manifest that instead of manifesting all the shit. You know, we don't have to do that. So, yeah, it's all on the up. We're heading back towards the golden age slowly. And things are going to keep getting better.
Yeah.
Not for everyone all the time, but for more and more people gradually as we go on. So let's all stay positive.
Yeah. Nick Nomix put into the chat box, oral tradition had a strength we have lost. Books probably impaired memory, the same as a computer and mobile phone tech is doing now. And that takes me back to where you were at the beginning, saying that what you needed to do was look at the older books.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. It's actually, as soon as you go through the process of writing things down, actually, you kind of become a bit dependent on that and your notes, rather than what they used to do is just remember it all. You know, if you wanted to be a bad or an ovate, if you wanted to be a bad, you had to memorize like hundreds and hundreds of verses.
Yeah.
Of prose, you know, and again, those verses all contained all the sort of wisdom. But whereas now we want to, you know, write everything down. I think he's right. It does actually make your memory worse.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we used to remember phone numbers before they could be digitally stored, or at least I used to have a whole load of phone numbers in my head. And they say that basically remembering, I think it's more than a 7-digit number, takes a fair amount of concentration. But in the old days, many of us had lots of more than 7-digit numbers in there.
Oh, yeah. Well, if anyone's in Swansea, my number used to be 01792-897-641. There you go. So see if that's still in existence.
Here's one from Lee. He says, maybe ancient man realised that they had to write down on stone because every time a predictable visitor pops by, causes mayhem and mischief and sometimes major destruction and a nasty side effect of electromagnetically mentally wiping some of the populace.
Yeah, it kind of sums it up. Stone's much harder to erase, of course, yeah.
I certainly got the impression that some of these ancient people put stuff on massive, massive blocks of stone in places where you couldn't even swing a hammer. So it is as if they kind of knew that information keeps arising and falling away and arising and falling away.
Yeah, I think, you know, anyone who's lived through a more golden age is going
to... Oh, you're wiping in and out. You're going in and out there a bit. Could you repeat that for us?
Yeah, I was just saying about how people who've lived in a more golden age would be aware of the fact that they've come from a worse time and that perhaps things are going to get worse again before they get better. So you want to do as much as you can to sort of preserve the ancient wisdom for the people who are coming after you who might not be in such a good time, you know. So that's where all the mystery schools and that come from, you know, where they preserve that knowledge for those coming further, you know, coming behind them, so that it's not lost forever, you know.
Yeah, they're ascendants, as I like to call them, rather than descendants.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, that's been very good, Litmus. I'm going to, we're coming to the end of the show now, and I still want to play the other new song that you sent me, which is Nothing Without Love.
What was Lost Without Love.
Lost Without Love, sorry. What was your inspiration for that?
Well, just the feeling of unconditional love, to be honest. I was actually in... When I started writing that, I was in this spot that I'm in right now, up on the cliff top, and I was on my own. And I'm lucky to have found unconditional love a few times. Obviously for my kids, because that almost goes without saying, you know, how you feel about your children. But you know, if you're lucky, you get to find it in a sort of life partner or a kindred spirit or whatever you want to call it. And I was just sort of imagining. Because I was on my own and I was without her at that time, and I was thinking, well, what, you know, what would it be like if she wasn't there, you know, and what would the world be like without love, you know, and without unconditional love, and I sort of tied it into the astrology. So if you look at the lyrics, you'll find all the four elements are in there, and it talks about, you know, one of the aims of astrology is to become your sun and leave behind your moon, because your moon represents your personality that you show the world, whereas your sun represents your true sort of spiritual nature. So,
oh, that's very interesting, because those are the ceremonies I've been talking about on the show and to you. One of the things that happens in the later ceremonies is that we get reconnected a circuit that goes right from us into the heart of the sun. And another thing that they talk about a lot is the fact that the moon is some kind of gatekeeper, if you like, another part of the program that interferes with our consciousness by giving us reverse light from the sun and all of that. So it's quite interesting that you've come up with that lyric.
Well, absolutely, and I'm, you know, it's only my lyric interpreting what I've learnt from astrology, and I've just sort of, but that does really resonate with me. You know, I do think we've been quite dominated by the moon and everything that goes with it, and we gotta get away from that and get back to the sun, get back to the light, you know, and leave the moon there in the darkness, as I say. But I just found studying astrology, it helps you to kind of elevate a bit and control your emotions more and not be a victim of your desires and all that kind of thing. And you know, and you just unconditionally loving someone, it's just a great feeling. And so I kind of wrote that song for Danny, you know, me darling, and you know, and my kids and you and all the people I love and for everyone, really, anyone who's experienced unconditional love, that's for you.
Very good. Well, thanks very much for joining us, Litmus. I'll put on the tune and have a quick word with you. And thank you very much for spending the time. I've enjoyed our chat.
Me too, as always, Doctor. Always a pleasure.
Very good. And here for you people out there is another of Litmus's latest song, Lost Without Love.